that too can be implemented. All you need is the right ideas. Mm-hmm. Everything will be settled, and you can love each other, and you can have a nice, tidy, decent world. Yeah. It's a mistake. It's something to do with the collapse of socialism in the United States.
Yeah.
It's a lifelong socialism, still is.
Yeah.
Something's gone wrong with it.
Yeah.
But the idea that a beautiful world can be created by believing the right principles will do. And he thinks Aristotle is right, because ethical virtues are not simply attributes of certain types of conduct, good, bad, right, wrong, beautiful. Because that's what I think about this practical reason, let's say. Sometimes it's to do with people behaving in certain circumstances to other people.
Yeah.
And therefore, it doesn't have something entirely to do with negotiation with people. Attempt to create a decent life out of conflicting values.
Yeah.
And the different people between conflicting values. Except, in the case of the Nazis, he says there is such a thing as absolute evil. And it's absolutely evil because he thinks Nazism is nihilism. He accepts, remember Rauschning, wrote a book called what is it called, the Revolution of Nihilism, something there. He thinks that Hitler and his followers, what they disliked was the entire universe of promises, fulfillment, virtue, decency, negotiation, truth, promises, all that has to be removed for naked power asserting itself in a free fashion, to clear the universe of all this liberal rubbish.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
For the whole accumulation of liberal values and arrangements and beliefs and everything people construct their lives around.
Yeah.
Mainly the heritage, French Revolution, equality, liberty, and all these things, and virtue and, I don't know, kindness, goodness, and generosity. All that's been thrown out, and instead of that you have clear it out, then you have a vacuum, then you just go forward. You know what you like.
Yeah.
Any obstacle that is worked out.
Yeah.
I think that's quite a good thing to say, but I don't think it's true. I mean, I think that, he said, well, maybe racism is an ideology. That is a belief. The rest is not, you see. The rest is just a kind of supposition. But the racism, he thinks, maybe is, in a sense, some sort of doctrine. It's a principle, that it's some kind of theory.
Mm-hmm. See, I think that's where the problem is, surely. I mean, the opposition, the hatred of the Jews was quite principled.
But wait a minute. No, but Jews, he's wrong, because he says it comes from Rene, his first wife and died. Mm-hmm. She never believed, she didn't even use the word Jew either, Israeli, or a Jew by religion, otherwise Jews wouldn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Either you were a Jew, instead you were Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
Or there are citizens of the state of Israel. But in between, what is that? What do you mean, Jew? So it's racist, and you see, I mean, either religion or politics. If you denied that the word Jew could have any meaning outside that, that's a very extreme position.
Mm.
Some Marxist kind. I'm going to tell you how we see, but anyway, that's what she believed, and it's rather infected him.
Yeah.
And I just say Nancy, and that's very different than that.
Yeah.
You know, it's also a kind of blind leftism, or very pragmatic.
Yeah. To clear up for me where...
So then he's wrong about the Jews.
Where he's wrong about
the Jews. He says the following. He says, because the Jews weren't allowed to own land, well known simple doctrine, they had to go into trade. So far it's true. Because they had to go into trade, they had to calculate, they had to sharpen their brains, they had to be ingenious. They developed habits of complicated thought. They had to count, and calculate, and predict, and analyze, and all this is kind of using the intellect. So the intellect being developed by this. The result was that they stood for intellectualism, for liberalism, for combinations of various sorts, for theories, for ideas. That the Nazis hated. They wanted to sweep that out, which is true. And there's something in it. I mean, they didn't want clever Jews. I mean, the whole idea of sort of clever sort of calculation, analysis, cleverness, thinkers, I mean, theorists. It's true they were against all that. They wanted the Siegfrieds about sort of wielding clubs or swords or something. It's true enough. That's an image. What one didn't want was a lot of sort of cunning, kind of guilty of it at all. People are devoted to the intellect, the world of what might be called the world of thought or ideas, in any form, applied or pure. You see? And criticism and so on, never born out of it. Well, hence, the violent anti-Semitism, that isn't true. The violent anti-Semitism is earlier than that, and it's racist. And they really did believe in race. And they did believe the Jews were sub-men, and they believed the Russians were doing less, not to do with intellect. I can see that if you're going to be under the influence of Marxism, that kind of thing, you have to work out some kind of sociological doctrine, which can't be found on something so meaningless as racism. But that's weak of them. That's a relic of some kind of liberal socialism. Right. And my view is that the whole thing
it makes it too rational, you
say. Well, yes, and
it makes it too much the product of interest.
Look, he really thinks the Jews stand for 19th century sort of culture. And that they hate it. It's true they do, and they did hate it. And that's why T.S. Eliot didn't like them. That's why Toynbee didn't like them. But it doesn't account for Hitler.
Well, yes.
You see what I mean? Absolutely. It accounts for, I don't know, even Ezra Pound, perhaps. Mm. It accounts for conservatives, yeah, like, of Jews, I mean, sort of pious. I mean, it's like the Jews of Ruskin, probably, was not anti-Semitic, but he could be. Yeah. The Carlyle was. Because they hated the 19th century and all it stood for. They hated the, what Burke said, remember? They suffered stuff, calculated as upon us. Yeah. Very chivalry. Yeah. You see, all right, well, Jews came off in the 19th century, which is the trade, civilization, thought, cleverness, use of the intellect, criticism, doctrines, theories.
Yes, and you were reproached in the late 20th century. You were reproached in the late 20th century by Roger Scruton for being dry and cold and deaf to the deeper emotions of the human heart, and it all comes back.
The same thing. Where is eroticism? Joseph, there's plenty to say about that. I can't be accused. You know, there's more than Scruton, I'll tell you about that.
I've derailed you.
You know about cowling, do you?
Yes.
I'm about to tell you. Wait. So then, the root of anti-Semitism, let me inform you, and into the machine, is the Gospels. Yeah. That is the ember. Because you're a child at school, and you learn about people who killed the Lord, killed God. They're called Jews. You've no idea who they are, you've never met one. I mean, it's nothing real in your life. You're living in the deep Canadian countryside, I mean, anything you like. You live in some of the back of Saskatchewan. Or you live in the middle of Iowa.
Wherever you are, you learn that the Jews...
There is something called Jews. They're a sinister group. They're a long time ago. But still, there is a sort of penumbra of sinisterness which covers the word. And that is transmitted. So when the word Jew is used, it's already has some pejorative flavor. That's not enough to create pogroms by itself. And then that's the ember. Then you need winds to blow it. Then you get all this anti-intellectualism, economics, scapegoats, anything you like, you see? But these are factors which blow the ember into flame. But even when the flame is extinguished, the ember glows on. That's my view. I once talked to a Catholic priest about that, who agreed. If you're a great Catholic, you know that to be true. You didn't believe it. So long as the Gospels are read, there will be the roots of anti-Semitism. They needn't be active, they needn't resolve. You can overcome it, you can say, these are not the same people, and the Pope says they're really Romans, and Jews aren't to blame anyway, and the Jews are descended, but it never knows what happened 2,000 years ago. All this can be said. But nevertheless, the word carries disagreeable implications through the Middle Ages. Yeah. That's where it comes from. Yeah. That's why Jews poison wells, that's why they burn hosts in their stoves, and that's why if they're converted, they're okay. Middle Ages, no racism. Yeah. Converted Jews, absolutely okay. Jessica, who is Shiloh's daughter, is in order. Yeah. She's a Christian, she's all right. Mm. Doesn't cling to her. Yeah. Nor did it in the Middle Ages. I think if you were a convert, well, might be some suspicion that you weren't completely lapsed. In Spain, you get Inquisition, tends to smoke you out, because they think you aren't a complete Christian. But if you are, then, it's all right. There's no sense of blood or soil, none of that, you see. That's later. It's a secular
form. Yes, I find this stuff troubling. It may take us away from our subject, but I entirely agree that the roots of anti-Semitism are Christian. I don't have any difficulty with that doctrine. The difficulty I have is that the Christian doctrine, or the Christian interpretation of the Gospels, has so many possible paths that it was possible, for instance, in my childhood to grow up not receiving the message that Jews crucified Christ, or to the degree that they did, Christ was also a Jew. It happened in a place called Palestine.
If you read the Gospels simply, if you read the Gospels in a naive version, never mind what your schoolmaster will do, you just read it.
Yeah.
He just says, the Jews crucified Christ.
Yeah.
And they wanted Barabbas. Mm. When Pilate said, which do you want?
Yeah.
The entire, as in the Matthew version. Yeah. That's a kind of simple, yeah. Bach is a very good example of what I mean.
Yes. Crucify him, crucify him.
Barabbas, crucify him, crucify him, see? Yeah. All that. Well, that's quite normal. The normal impression is that then it's more sophisticated to say, after all, you must remember, Christ was a Jew himself. But he wasn't a Jew, he was God. Yeah. If you're God, you're not a Jew, or anything else. Or is there, you happen to be called a Jew. Yeah. Well, Joseph was a Jew, yes. Virgin Mary was a Jew, it's all right. But that's a rather paradox. If you say that, it comes slightly surprising. Mm. It should be.
I just think there's a historical puzzle about how anti-Semitism passes through the various Christian traditions, because I don't think it passes through the Catholics the same way it passes through the Protestants.
Well, it passes through early Christianity. In early Christianity, you have hatred of the Jews immediately, because the enemy, the Jewish sects, one of which hates the other. I mean, the early Christians are all Jews, or very nearly all. And then they hate the other, the Jews hate them as heretics and frightful sort of apostates, and they'll hate the Jews for killing Christ on. That gets going in the 2nd century, 3rd century. And after that, it doesn't cease. The Jews aren't popular anyway.
Yeah.
Because they keep themselves to themselves. They're funny. Because the Romans didn't like the Jews before Christ. I mean, Cicero makes nasty remarks about them. Because they're kind of sinister. See, God knows what they're at. They went into Mary. They didn't talk to us. I mean, they brought themselves all right, to some extent. But still, he just says, who is it? Either he or Tesla says that enemies of the human race. Also, he's getting his money because they hate everybody else in the world. Violently opposed to the whole world around them. So that doesn't make them popular. But you don't actually massacre them.
Yeah.
And the Emperor Claudius, you see, produced a rescript against them because there's a pogrom. Jews and Greeks have a frightful fight in Alexandria. And he wanted to tell the Jews, shut up. Not go on, or they'll be punished. That's just racial riots.
Yeah.
I mean, you just want to squash.
Yeah.
Not interested in the details of it, you just tend on disorder.
Yeah.
All right. But the real antisemitism, I think, begins with the fact that Jews are in some way a criminal element. Mm. And sinister, as you speak, are wicked. Mm. Wicked lot. That you don't get the focus of the entity. And it comes directly from the fathers, all of whom are anti-Semitic. The early fathers all are. Augustine is a lot.
Does this account strikes me as plausible? I wanted to lead
it's
it back.
It's very sophisticated. Not till the Renaissance you get people like Mirandola associating with Jews, trying to Jewish mysticism, the Kabbalah, pottering about.
Yeah.
That's very elaborate and hyper.
Do you feel that Stuart just doesn't? The fact that Stuart Hampshire just doesn't understand.
Doesn't want to understand. And it's perfectly well what it is. When he says that this is Jewish, it's just kind of anti-intellectual, anti-civilized. Just Jewish civilization, and they're trying to get rid of it. So the fact there's something in it. I mean, his Nazis did think on that.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't account for Russian anti-Semitism, which is just violent in its own way.
Mm-hmm. But is it your view that the Gentiles just basically don't understand this? Can't.
Don't understand what?
Anti-Semitism.
What it is, you mean?
Yeah.
Yes, I think it's just Jews are funny, sinister, all different associators, something funny, dishonest, thieves, crooks.
No, but did you know, I meant your friends.
No, but I mean the concept of anti-Semitism is people don't think about.
But I meant Gentile friends, non-Jewish friends, people as close to you as Stuart, do you feel a kind of gulf with them over this issue, that
they
basically don't get it in their guts.
They don't want to realize that there are irrational factors which cannot be explained on ultimately socio-economically socio-political grounds. I mean, the only idea that there is a thing is religion. There is a very powerful factor. He's willing to admit sexes. Religion? No. It's just ultimately nonsense. For him. He's a rational socialist, and religion is just false beliefs of a primitive kind. That's all it is, you see. If you believe that, then it's rather, I mean, after Europe 90s, here's Germany, one of the most civilized countries in the 20th century. It says, high civilization, and yet, well, you can't attribute it to primitivism or religious feelings, because the Lutheran Church isn't like that. I mean, most Germans didn't find these primitive peasants. We do, as a matter of fact. But, of course, I mean, Oberammergau is a tremendous source of it,
yeah,
locally and so on.
Absolutely.
Of course.
Absolutely.
Why not? We'll see.
I'm glad we've raised this subject, because I was reading these marvelous and very touching memoirs by your dad, your father.
Oh, yes, but I never read. I've never read a single line.
Really?
No. I always thought it might be embarrassing, and he said he was doing it, and I thought he oughtn't to, and he'd probably write a lot of nonsense, and then he might write anything.
Well, I can
I've
assure you.
I've never read a single line.
I can assure
I've
you.
I've asked Frank Lombardi to return the original to me.
Good.
Just to have a look.
Good. Well, I hope you will, because it says...
What does it say? The English must be really imperfect, too.
The English? No, quite wrong.
Quite good,
the English is...
Quite good?
...flavored with certain unmistakable Russian word orders.
Yes.
That's very precise.
I see.
And very...
What does it talk about?
...nicely expressed.
I've
it
never
talks
had a single
about
line. I simply stuffed it away in a drawer, and in this way it went about it.
Well, what it says is this. It says, since we have discovered that the Nazis have exterminated our people,
our families,
you must know, we must know
who they are.
Who they are. And so it goes back to the 18th century. It goes back to
the Hasidim.
To the Hasidim.
That's correct.
It goes back to the Jewish teacher from whom you were descended.
No, the original, the founder of the Lubavitch sect.
Yes, exactly. It goes back to that.
It's the most tremendously, the richest of all Jewish sects.
Yeah. Hello.
The descent comes from Michael Schneur Zalman, who is the founder of the Lubavitch sect. That's where he lived.
Yes.
And that is the best, most richest, and most proselytizing sect of all the Jews at present.
Yeah.
They've grown enormously.
Yes.
And the center is Brooklyn. It's Washington Heights.
Yeah.
And they knock people about in the streets in Jerusalem. They use physical violence. They do that in New York too.
Yes. And this is where you come from.
This is where I come from.
Yeah.
But
with
when
obviously with a sense of recoil.
When I see them in the street, I spit.
Really?
Yes.
Why?
Because I think they're hateful.
Why?
Because I think they're everything that's awful. They're fanatical, anti-rational, fanatical, anti-Arab, anti-Gentile, that's exactly what Cicero thought. They're a hateful, a frightful, hateful sect of bigots. They're extremely imaginative, because they're sort of fundamentally, they're like the Quakers or the Methodists.
Yes.
I mean, the revolt was against ecclesiasticism, rationalism,
yes,
learning, and in favor of union with God, mysticism, emotion, direct inspiration by God, like the German Pietists, but the imperial too. You see, well, it starts in the 18th century, early 18th century. My man happens to be the leader in Russia.
Yeah.
It begins I can't remember.
Exactly.
Well, why do I hate them now? Because
originally
I knew them as a child.
In what way did you know them as a child?
In Riga.
Yes.
When I was born. The man who was the millionaire, but who I've told you,
yes,
my father probably mentions,
yes,
from the name Berlin comes.
Yes.
He was a Hasid.
Yes.
And that's why there is a relationship, because he married the granddaughter of one of the,
yes,
notable, the number three teacher,
yes,
in the dynasty, number three.
Yes.
And the granddaughter, that was our, I told you, the only way of status, the only way to among the Bale of Settlement among the pious Jews of Rosh Al-Poland, not among the emancipated ones, but among the bulk, which is 90% at least, of the sort of religious Jews, there were only two ways of achieve status. One was by wealth, and one was by piety, by learning. Mm. Not piety, learning. Mm. Therefore, the rich men always wanted their daughters to marry sons of the great scholars. And the great scholars wanted their daughters to marry sons of rich men. And there was a genetic effect of all this, which produced, I suppose, a certain amount of ability on the part of certain families. Whereas they all descended in genes, means that they descend from people who achieved some kind of prominence somewhere in the sort of human activities. Yeah. Well, all right. Now this rich man was the son of the original man who built railways, I think I told you, and he went once a year, once 2 years, to Lubavitch to see the Rebbe, who is the guru, who said sacred things. The women used to ask and pray for having children, or the merchants used to say, I might have a bankruptcy, or whatever. He was a Delphic oracle.
Yes.
He was a Delphic oracle. Yes. Now, since he was that, my father was his favorite pseudo-grandson. He was, in other words, he was married to my father's grandmother, married to the sister of my father's grandmother. Mm-hmm. And he was therefore his great-nephew by marriage. Mm-hmm. Now, he had a synagogue of his own. He built one entirely to which he could go and his people could go there. He dominated, he owned it. Mm-hmm. And like having a church built for your own personal use, mm-hmm. chapel. Mm-hmm. And that was filled with Hasidim. And that's where I was taken by my parents from time to time, not every Saturday, not every Sabbath, but every time on the high holidays, at the age of 3, 4, 5. And that I remember too dimly.
What do you remember?
Well, just in this room, with bearded men, and the sounds of prayer, which I heard since various contexts. Mm-hmm. That's all I remember. You see, I didn't know any of them personally, but I remember being taken. Some man, some beetle, some servant of his would say, the master, roughly speaking, that something or other wants you all go to the Bida by 10. So everyone went to the Bida by 10. And that I vaguely remember. Then in Petrograd, again, we went to the proper synagogue, which was not Hasidic at all, which was of the Rodeo, of the majority, but next door to it, there was a little Hasidic Stiebel, as they were called, which comes from Stube, which means, as you know...
It was in Weinstube.
What?
No.
German Stube. The German Stube means a room.
Yes.
And therefore Stube, Stübel. Stübel, Stiebel. Stiebel means a little attachment where these pious Hasidim is together.
Yes.
To which from time to time, my father used to drop into it to see how they were getting on there. Very vaguely, I remember that. Then we came back to Riga in 1919, I think I went once, twice, to this synagogue, it still existed. Mm-hmm. It's called the Berlin Synagogue. Mm-hmm. You see, it's exactly what it was called. So I remember these. I had nothing against them, on the contrary. My sense was they were jollier than the other Jews, they were full of vitality. Mm-hmm. That's what they were, I mean, they were not dried up.
In what respect did their services or their gatherings differ from...
Not much. No, they were not heretic. They were not dissident anyway. They were not a sect. They were disapproved.
They weren't more exuberant in their devotion.
They were.
They were
like early Methodists, or they were like early rollers, or Quakers, or Shakers, or whatever it might be. Yes, they were. That's to say, they were more passionate, yes. And that was attracted me. And the people of mine used occasionally to come to our house, I suppose, were much more full of being, vitality, general optimism about life, not dried up, pale, sort of learned, sort of dry biscuits, which is what the others were. You see what I mean? So in that sense, I was rather for them. I felt there was a lot of life there, and the religion was genuine. It was not hypocritical.
So when
it was not mechanical.
So when did this hatred or dislike begin?
The last 10 years, I mean. Yes, I mean, since they became political, I mean, since they began misbehaving in Israel, you see, and misbehaving here, and denouncing everybody and being a sort of intolerant persecutors and going about the streets fully, I mean, dressed in uniform, which is not necessary. Yeah. I mean, aggressively dressed in sort of, you know, with long side locks and black hats, you've seen them. You see, and stopping people in the streets of New York as a kind of holy wagon which they roll along, which dispenses phylacteries and prayer books. They stop Jews in the streets saying, "When have we last prayed? What about? Here's a prayer book. Next tomorrow morning, why don't you do it? It'll make you feel better." That is crazy too. That's when I began hating them.
Yeah.
I began hating when they became black. They just became sort of black reactionists, which they weren't before, because nothing to be reactionary about. They were talking about the Jew persecuted living under Jewish disabilities, and rather more jollier than the others. They were also accused by the great majority, they were a small sect, of drinking vodka in order to get themselves into a holy state, not just by prayer, but by certain stimulants.
Yeah.
A different kind. That's kind of charge put against
them.
You see?
Now, your father's, what I would want to get more precise is your father and your mother's relation to that Hasidic tradition.
They were first cousins, remember?
Yes. What comes through very powerfully in your father is just 100% sense of Jewish tradition, tremendously strong. And it came slightly as a surprise because the portrait you paint of him to me is of a very...
Of him?
Of him.
No, he didn't belong to that tradition. That's worked up in his old age.
You think so?
He was totally emancipated. I mean, he didn't eat kosher, he didn't have anything to do with it. He was bored by going to the synagogue. I mean, this, I think, is recidivity.
So full of little Hebrew quotations.
Exactly.
Slight statements to the effect that what's slightly a shame about you, Isaiah, is that you neglected your Talmud.
Exactly.
You know, and you think this is kind of assembled in retrospect.
He certainly didn't remember about the Talmud at all. He didn't know it. He'd been taught it.
Yes.
But I mean, of course he had certain Hebrew or even Aramaic expressions which were inculcated into him in his childhood.
Yeah.
He was brought up in total piety, my father. But I think towards the end of his life, as sometimes happens, there is a certain sentimental return to roots of some kind.
Yeah.
It's true that when Israel was declared, my father was not a Zionist.
Yeah.
But he did go to Israel in 1950, I think, soon after it became a state. And was terribly moved, as all Jews are. And then began saying, how wonderful, what I remember is each sitting under his vine and under his olive tree, for the Bible.
Yes,
we see sitting, sort of peasant, idealized peasant life.
Yes.
See each and sitting under his individual tree,
you
see, in the country. Well, that moved him, because he remembered all these texts. And so towards the end of his life, he was moved by all this. But this is sentimental return. The whole point, he broke away from it. Completely. I mean, there was no question of trying to make me more Jewish than I was. May have regretted it. I was never urged by him.
Oh no, he's clearly, the pages are full of the most touching forms of pride in your achievements.
Well, it's all right.
But it is, the dominant note of this piece from beginning to end is, we come from a certain Jewish tradition, we remained within that tradition, I remained within that tradition.
Oh yes, you're very proud of it. Simply because it was a real thing, because it was sectarian.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have done that as a Jew, simply. Simply because this was a particular sect, and he belonged to a kind of royal family.
Yes.
He belonged to the central branch, or the founder, and therefore in the genealogies, which they publish in Israel. There are two books entirely dedicated to genealogies. Yehudi Menuhin and I both occur. We're sixth cousins, descended in this original name.
Yes.
Not even once removed. Exactly six.
Yes, incredible.
You see, and he knows about all about it too. You see, but as it was a kind of terribly admired, I mean, enormously worshipped, the whole idea of Hasidim is they thought the Rebbe was in touch with God. I mean, he was a mystical union. What he said came directly from the Godhead, which the majority of Jews thought was superstition.
Yeah.
And disapproved of very strongly, thought just a lot of rot.
Yeah.
And conceit, megalomaniac superstition was disgusting. The German Jews thought it was a dreadful lapse to barbarism. Most terrible kind.
Yeah.
He has one extremely funny moment is that when he makes a tour of Germany and says all kinds of extremely amusing things about the before the First World War, on a business trip, habits of the German Jews, who are so pretentious that they won't even put up their umbrellas when they go to synagogue because it's labor. It's pitching a tent or something.
We're not allowed to carry.
Because
carrying is labor.
So they had a Gentile porter at the gates of these, the doors of these synagogues to open the things and to take them down. And he regarded that as the most ridiculous thing he'd ever seen in his life.
Quite.
But with a very strong sense that he came from Eastern European.
My father went to Germany again after the war. He went on a timber mission.
Yes.
With a rank of, I think, major.
Yeah.
Major's uniform. Very surprising thing for him to do.
Yeah.
And he confiscated the estates of Prince Bismarck.
Yes.
Does he tell that?
And richly enjoyed greeting.
Gigantic. He was an Anglomaniac, my father. Yeah. His manners emerge.
Yeah.
But his love and adoration of England were absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah.
Everything in this country was wonderful.
Yeah. And some of that's rubbed off on you.
Yes.
Has any of that sentimental return occurred in you?
To the Jews?
To the Jews, not to the Jews, since it seems to me, in a certain way, I meant to the religious element.
No. I go to the synagogue. I went yesterday to I didn't go to church because I had a frightful cold.
Mm.
But the night before, I went to the Yom Kippur service.
Yeah.
If you ask me why, four sentimental reasons, because I'd always had done. And because I believe in self-identification, nothing else. The prayers bore me.
Self-identification meaning
with the Jews.
You're willed.
Yes, there is a body called the Jews.
Yes.
No use denying that the Jewish nation, in some sense, tribe, nation, community, is very difficult to identify because the ordinary criteria identify.
But you identify with it.
Absolutely. If I'm asked what I am, I think I've told you.
Mm.
I'm English and so on, which many people take me to be. And if they know, I'm a Russian Jew.
Yeah.
That's what I am.
Yeah.
And that's indisputable. Everything else is
indeed
disputable.
It is, thank God.
Everything is disputable.
Thank God.
You're a straight Canadian, okay.
I'm more confused, but...
You're a Canadian of Russian origin.
Yeah.
Okay, no, but you are at least half authentic Canadian.
Yes, and you were saying to me last week, which I found touching and also
or a
half-caste, true.
Yes.
Yes, I'm a half-caste, but forget about me.
Yes.
What I found touching is when you said there were things that made you weep. One of them was the recollection of Jewish songs heard in that place near Pskov in 1915.
Oh, yes. In
now
the
what
little
was
prayer
that
house,
story?
In the where the Bible was taught.
Yeah.
Bible class.
Yeah.
Yes.
And what
Bible
how did that song go? Because it had a wonderful...
Oh, yes. About in the front of the stove, whatever it is, in the what's called pre-pitchik or something.
Pitch being
stove.
Yeah.
In the pre stove bit.
Yeah.
Means a bit metal bit which comes out.
Yeah.
Stove is there, but in front of the stove is a little fire. The stove itself has a lot of pots on it.
Yeah.
In a village, you see, of this huge thing made into a wall.
Mm.
As you stuff timber, logs into it, and you fry things or you boil them. On the actual surface of whatever it is made of.
Yeah.
But in front, the front is all right because that's where the logs burn.
Yeah.
And if you open it, that's the thing, then it communicates warmth to the single room in which the peasant family lives. And that is the thing. And that also occurs in this Bible classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And it says a little fire burns in this. And in the room, it's hot. In der Stube. It's almost German. Ist heiß. It's straight German, you see. Auf dem Pipitschik brennt das Feuerl. That's straight German. A little fire, sorry. When the wind in der Stube, die Jewish word, ist heiß. It's hot. Und der Rebbe, and die kleine Kinderlech, you can hear this.
Little children
learned, which means teaches, Aleph Beis, Hello, Bates is alphabet.
Alphabet.
Hello, Bates. Yeah. No. And then there is this very moving story to do with reduces the tears. Dear children, and when you get older, you will really... No, it's all this business about syllables, I tell you. Aleph with a stroke under his R. Bet with a stroke, another stroke under his ball. Whatever it is, you learn the syllables, yeah. Because the Hebrew language is no vowels. Yeah. All you have is consonants, but then you have little points underneath, yeah. Which indicate what the accent is. And you have to read without points. That's a done for children, so once you're grown up, you can do without that. And the guy has an Arabic, same thing. But anyway, and then the Arab, whatever it is, and then he said, when you will get older, dear children, you will realize how much blood and the tears are embodied in these letters. That's right. That moves, isn't it? But that is the history of the Jews. That's what Nehemiah said when, it's a wonderful, typical Nehemiah remark. Lord Darby said to me, I've told you that.
Tell me again, I love it.
So wonderful. Lord Darby said to me, Nehemiah, you're a Jew. Why do you write Jewish history, English history? Why don't you write Jewish history? I said to him, Darby, which is the top point of the story. I said to him, Darby, there is no Jewish history. There is only a Jewish martyrology. That is not amusing enough for me. But get the old name.
Yes,
the rudeness,
yes.
The certain grim wit,
yes.
The called Darby Darby,
yes,
the pride, the rejection of this, yeah. Sort of patronizing attitude. You see, they call it Darby, and the contempt for Jewish history, the boredom of Jewish history,
yeah.
And the pleasure in English history, the history of a successful nation instead of a total failure. You see? Anyway, what I think is true about me, and this is what is true about my fathers and so on, is that I know so much about the life of these people and their values and the expressions they use and so on, but when anyone writes anything, or anyone talks about it, I can correct them.
Yes.
And I'm interested in almost anthropologically,
yes.
in my origins,
yes.
as everybody is,
yes.
Just as you are in your, yes. Ignatieff.
You don't recognize right. Those pages, do you?
You're talking to me exactly as...
I know, as if you were in a court, you poor man.
No, as a court executive. As a court. I've never told you the story of the younger brother of the first president of the USSR, whom I met, who was a French ambassador.
Yeah.
And it sounds surprising to you, too.
No, but I'm baffled. You tell me that. More.
And right here. I mean you to be.
History of Hasidism.
Routine has misspelled it.
Doesn't sound quite like you.
No, it's not me. No, it's nothing with me.
Could it be your father?
I didn't write it, no.
You don't know who wrote it?
Where does this come from?
Hardy provided it and doesn't know where it came from.
Nothing to do with him or me.
Fine.
I've never read it.
Fine. Okay.
Someone must have given it to me.
Yeah.
And I must have stuffed it in the cupboard. For the rest.
Okay. That's all I wanted to know.
It's about... I wonder what it is.
It's unsigned and unfinished.
You see, whatever a man says, today is a movement which has nearly disappeared, still exists in backwaters, some parts of Poland, southeastern Europe, and Ruthenia, for example. Shaped very differently from the original form, rather very degenerate form. Dr. Zygmunt, hysterical revivalism. Father Divine, New York. Amy McPherson.
It seems pre-Second World War.
Oh, sure, because I mean, now Hasidism is
booming.
Very, very booming. Booming so much that the Roman community, community of the Jews of Rome, which has existed for 18 centuries, has been broken up by these people. Broken up by them, and they managed to split it, get a lot of young men to join them, and completely disrupted this polite, ancient, rather half-dead, perfectly imagined, very respectable, sort of Huguenot-like community, yes. You see? Which is what they were. The chief rabbi of Rome is in despair. They make more converts than anybody does in the world now. Because they find these sad young men, but I mean, take Zalman Cowan, who is the Governor General of Australia. His two sons are frantically pious. They've grown beards, alongside girls, and sit in the interior of Jerusalem, hating the government. I mean, I ask you, he's in despair. How did this happen?
You would be too.
I met his son in Australia. He's a good student at Canberra. Perfectly ordinary Western boy. His two ideas, suddenly.
Boom.
This. It's rather like, it's like the Oxen of Virginia. It's some kind of spiritual revival. Or people in some way found their parents and their empty.
Well, it's where all that godless, desiccated liberalism practiced by people like Isaiah Berlin will get you.
Of course, that's the truth. Let me tell you something I can tell you. There is a Michael Cowling, you know.
Yes. Yes, Morris Cowling and Peter has.
He's the father of the whole thing.
Yes.
His grandfather is Oakeshott and Butterfield. That's where it begins.
Yes.
But Cowling is the main inspirer at the moment. And what's the name of the worship team? Westhorn.
Yes.
He comes to Peter House. They all do. Like my colleague Tom. Well, he's written a book, as you know, writing a book, about Mormons, spiritual evolution of British society. Trevor Roper, we made master, and then quarreled with, of course, thought it was a terrible mistake. Turned out not to be as conservative as was hoped. He reviewed the first volume quite favorably. Profound things in it. After the quarrel, he reviewed the second volume with extreme irony and contempt. The third volume was about Topia, about 20th century, mainly about the war and after. I said, the chapter devoted to me. I am the instigator of the Second World War, which was a ghastly mistake. Things should never have gone to war. It all happened because they lost an empire and all our property, and it was not in the interests of the United Kingdom to go to war against Hitler. That's the thesis. And presumably the people made them responsible for liberals and intelligentsia and God knows who. You see what I mean? Churchill, I didn't know quite what part he played in this. Anyhow, but for some reason, I am responsible, according to Westhorn, who's read the chapter. I was about 30 years at the time. I was not politically involved in any way. I was writing, so far as I was doing anything, I was thinking about theory of knowledge. I had written on Karl Marx, but no doubt was not sufficiently anti-Marxist in character, but still, you see. But for some reason I could see him, I'm the symbol for him, everything which he hates.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter socially so much, because they're fervent. What he doesn't want is these liberal atheist, liberal intellectuals, polite, quite amiable personally, who disrupt the whole religious basis. Spiritual basis on which every society, society is founded. Yes, I mean, that's the heart of England.
Yeah.
And if that is desiccated, England falls to pieces. You see? Mm-hmm. I mean, that must be the thesis.
Got a lot to answer for, as
I know. His hero, you see, I think, is Manning, who, despite being Catholic, he knew the right idea, which is Catholic theocracy. A lot of Irish, ignorant Irish peasants on the top of the hierarchy. That's the way.
How do you explain this kind of virulent, stupid conservatism? It does seem very peculiar.
He must have been he's an eccentric figure. I think from the very beginning, I've seen him.
Yes.
It's partly because he and Oakeshott planted all their friends. There was a thing called the Carlyle Club. That was not Thomas Carlyle. I remember a very sweet man called Canon Carlyle, who was a chaplain of University College, friend of William Morris, I think, who was a sort of mild, sweet old liberal. He and his brother wrote the History of Political Ideas in the Middle Ages, famous book, six volumes. with a very sweet liberal clergyman, extreme holiness, very nice man. And he had a little discussion club of political issues. When I first became a member after the war, he was almost the youngest member of it. People in the room when you entered were the following. Professor Poeck was not young, a medieval
Morris
historian.
Poeck.
Famous, but a great medieval historian. Lord Samuel, not Miss Bloom of Youth. Sir David Ross, famous Aristotelian scholar, Prophet of Orion. R.C.K. Ensor, the sort of German historian. Beveridge, wait a moment, Dorney. So you see, there were these noble liberal figures, really. Webster, historian. Noble, sort of honorable liberal figures of a sort of establishment kind. And then, after all these people died off, Oakeshott, who was the treasurer, I think, planted, managed to get elected to it. Oh, you can imagine Cowling, the man at London University succeeded Popper. Oakeshott succeeded Popper. Minogue, and so on, you see what I mean? And that Jewish lady, esteemed conservative, pupil of Oakeshott, you know what I mean? What's her name? Letwin, Shirley Letwin, her husband, Trevor Roper, Blake, it became too much. So Herbert Hart, Stuart Hampshire, and I couldn't take it. We left. But Bernard Williams, you remember?
Yes.